Coins of India, so it's completely wrong. Coins and coineries of minces.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I would like to welcome you to another of the Complexity Group seminars. I'm Eve Middleton-Kelly and I'm the director of the Complexity Group. We are very, very pleased to have Chris Matheson today. And it continues the series we've had on energy and climate change with I think, quite a significant difference today, because Chris will also bring in the question of the economy. In 2005, Chris had one of his major changes in his life. He was vice president of SAIC, which is a large organization of 40,000 people, and he was in the life sciences division. So nothing to do with economics or peak oil or climate change. But he was very much intrigued about the idea that the economy was in fact an open, not a closed system. Closed system being the prominent assumption at the time. From then on, he became intrigued by the story of peak oil and then the wider world of the environment. By 2006, the whole story somehow came together into focus for him. And then it took him about 2 years to complete what he's probably best known for now, which is the crash course. And he now speaks to quite eminent fora. For example, yesterday he was at the House of Commons talking to the All-Party Parliamentary Committee on peak oil and gas, and he's also spoken at the UN, and he will be speaking also at the Department for International Development, and I think very, very welcome to you, Chris.
Thank you.
Please.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I see some faces I recognize in this audience, including one that goes back pretty far. So you have in the audience people who can attest to my story and whether it's changed or how true it's been over the years, actually. Dan, how long ago was that?
It was a couple of years ago. A
couple of years ago now. So this story has come a long way. What you're going to see today is a 45-minute condensation of a 3.5-hour body of work that's online. That's called the Crash Course, which itself is the condensation of a lot more material than that. So you're seeing the tip of the iceberg today. By necessity, I'm going to have to skip over some key concepts. I will direct you, if you're interested, to chase them down further, to go to the Crash Course, where I think it's pretty succinctly explained. There's a very big story that's lurking out in plain sight today. And I think that it really behooves us to take a good hard look at it and understand what this is. I'm not going to be presenting a huge amount of data today. Today is about getting the story out around how this data would fit together. So right now we've got a story going on out there in the press that says, you know, we need to balance economic growth with carbon dioxide, which is going to be a very tricky thing to do because they're both actually on the same side of the seesaw. At least if we look at the last 200 years of industrialization, this has always been true. You want more economic growth, you're going to have more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and vice versa. So the question becomes not balancing the two, but understanding the way in which they interact. And in digging that story apart, we discover something, that nothing in this story is simple. We have very complicated systems all interacting with each other, and I'm going to talk about three of those systems at the highest possible level. This is the formula by which you can remember all of today, if you remember nothing else. It's not really a formula, but I'm going to talk about three E's. I'm going to add two Q's to it, and we're going to end up with one very large P. So there, you can get that off and tell that to your spouse at home. You'll get it all. The first E I want to talk about out of three is the economy. I care deeply about the economy. I'm very passionate about it. I study it obsessively. I write about it constantly. This is the lens through which I primarily look at the world, because this is how we organize ourselves. If we don't have a functioning economy, all of our technological dreams will not happen. This is the means by which we apportion resources, divvy things up, and get stuff done. So if there's anything that's going to threaten this, it's going to threaten everything else that we care and hold near and dear. This is the thing I desperately want to continue forward as we go forward, so my children have the same sort of opportunities I did. The economy is attached to a second E, energy. And in particular, I'm going to focus today on petroleum. This is a very important linkage because, of course, without energy in your society, all the money in the world doesn't make a bit of difference. I mean, if you're on a barren rock with a million pounds of gold, you figure that out pretty quickly. You'd rather have this than a bunch of paper money or any other representation of money. And both of these are, of course, connected to this larger thing, the planet, the Earth, the environment. And the focus I'm going to bring to this today is going to be around the concept of resources and the ways in which we use resources. Carbon dioxide is on the pollutant side, which is the downstream side. I'm going to be looking at the upstream side, which is the feeding of resources coming from the world through our economy. All right. When I look across those three E's, I see so many warning lights on our national global dashboards that I think it would be prudent at this point to hit the brakes, pull over, take a good hard look at what's going on, because there's just an immense number of things out there that should give us pause and say, there's something here we need to understand better. And it all leads to this one statement. I've been saying this statement for a number of years. I truly believe the next 20 years are going to be completely unlike the last 20 years, very significantly. And this is important because as a person, as an institution, as a government, you tend to base what's about to happen on what's just happened. That works well during normal periods, but if there's a sharp corner, if there's some deflection in the overall path, this can actually be a huge liability, basing the future on the immediate past. So I'm going to tell you why this statement is true to me, and that's what we're really going to be talking about today. In 2003, I thought the dollar was going to get into a lot of trouble for macroeconomic reasons. I wrote prominently about a housing bubble that I saw developing well before that was a popular thing to do. I did think that one realtor at one conference I was at was going to track me down in the parking lot after I gave a talk about the housing bubble during the height of it. He was very unhappy with me. I talked about in May of 2008, I thought stocks were going to decline, and I did all of this. I'm not a financial advisor. I'm not an economist. How did I see these things coming? How did I see this credit crisis developing? For me, this was not a hard thing to do. And I don't even take a lot of intellectual credit for it because it was just too obvious. In my country, we doubled our level of debt, doubled it, from $26 trillion to $52 trillion in 8 years, and we didn't increase the means to pay that debt back. Our incomes were stagnant, and our GDP didn't grow by even a fraction of that amount. Well, that's obvious. Debt's climbing, income's stagnant. You have a credit crisis coming. So the question was only when. Now, that was the part I got lucky on, but to me, this wasn't a prediction. It's not really a prediction if you say, well, the train is going too fast, there's not enough track left, and the conductor happens to be drunk. What happens next? Not really a prediction. It's just something that happens, right? I think we've got some things out there which are in a similar vein like that. So conventional economics right now, this is a view of the world and how conventional economics looks at it. For those of you who aren't math-oriented, let me simplify that equation for you. It's the equation for growth. And not just any kind of growth. Those who can look at this is exponential growth. There's different types of growth. Mathematical, arithmetic growth. We go from 1 to 2 to 3. It's kind of how maybe your family grows, right? Exponential growth is 1 to 2 to 4 to 8 and so on, right? This type of growth is really important to understand because exponential growth, once we understand it, that this is at the very core of our economy, it has profound implications for what's going to come next, and I believe good predictive power as well. It gives us some insights once we understand it. And it starts with this stuff right here, money. I don't care what your money looks like. I don't care what color it is. I don't care how many dead presidents or ministers you've got on there. I don't care anything about it. All money in the world today shares one common characteristic, all of it. It's all the same because in every society out there, money is loaned into existence. And I'm not here to cast judgment on it. I'm not going to say it's good or bad. I just want to describe it and say this is the system. And this is how our money comes into being. It's kind of a shocking statement. It's a hard one for most people to get their minds around. But you can go to the Bank of England website or the Federal Reserve or the Ministry of Finance in Japan. It doesn't matter. They'll all explain this to you. I did have an economist take enormous exception to my work at one point early on. He absolutely was going against me. He said I fundamentally didn't understand money and that I had it all wrong. And I pulled out the comic book from the Federal Reserve that they produce that explains it. So you can actually order comic books from our Federal Reserve that tells you how this is true. And that quieted him down. It's a really shocking thing to get your mind around. It leads to something very important, and it's this. At any moment in time, there's always going to be more debt because we loan our money into existence, then there is money. In the United States right now, there's $52 trillion of this stuff, and there's only 10 to 14 trillion of this stuff. 52 to 10. Well, how do you pay back $52 trillion in debt off of 10 of these? Well, you can't. And plus, because all money is loaned into existence, in order to do that, we have to borrow the money to pay that back, which means this grows larger. So this is always growing larger than this. And that has a very profound set of implications for us, because debt is the organizing principle of our economy. Because it is, things grow exponentially, and all money systems enforce some behaviors, punish others. Debt's a very powerful motivator. If you're in debt, you will either default on that, or you will pay it back. But most people really, really work hard to pay it back. And that's also true for companies. That's also true for municipalities. And it's true for nations, sort of. So because we have that, we can sort of flip that key concept around and now say that perpetual growth, not just any type of growth, perpetual exponential growth is now, it's a requirement of our modern banking system, our money system, our economy. And by requirement, I'm not saying a legal requirement. It's not written down anywhere. It's a requirement like my body requires oxygen. Think of it this way. Last year in 2009, worldwide economic growth was minus 2%. And it looked like the world was coming to an end. Plus 2% growth, no problems. We wouldn't have heard a thing. Minus 2%, it's a huge problem. And that's because we have this requirement built in. Our economic system, which actually means our money system, is deeply unhappy unless it's growing, but not just growing, growing exponentially. Now, when we pile up debts like this, this is a chart of debt to GDP in the United States. This is in percentage terms, so this means there's 200, means there's twice as much debt as there is GDP. And this starts in 1925 for those in the back and continues on through present. And you'll notice there's this big bump back here. That's the 1930s. That was not the United States going deeper into debt. This is a ratio. So the debt stayed relatively constant. GDP fell away from under it, created that spike, but it's an anomaly. This part over here that I'm going to put in the red circle, this actually is not an anomaly like I described. This is actually debt climbing at the same time that GDP is climbing, but the debt is climbing faster than GDP, much faster. So the implicit assumption when you are growing your debts in this way is that the future is going to be larger than the present. Not just a little bit larger, exponentially larger. So my country has made a very large collective bet. And by collective, this is total credit market debt. That's state, federal, local, corporate, private, everything. Collectively, we've made a very large bet on how the future is going to unfold. But we're not alone. So here's a chart that came out recently that shows a variety of countries. There's the UK, I'll put a circle around that. The red bars are the stories we tell ourselves in the newspaper. So we say official debt to GDP is, you know, 100% or 80% or 70%. But those red bars ignore what we call off-balance sheet liabilities. Things that if you excluded them from your income and balance sheet statements as a corporation would land you in prison, but governments can do this, so they do. These are the pensions, entitlements for the most part, and other obligations that exist. That's the true debt of a nation, unless you plan to default on those obligations. And here we see something that now we're looking at just, and this is just government debts, right? Approaching 500% in a lot of cases, sometimes exceeding it. Greece's case, over 800% now. Once we add in private debt, corporate debt, these numbers go up. Now, we don't have any historical examples of countries getting this far in debt on an official basis without going through some sort of a crisis. Could be a monetary crisis of some form, could be a fiscal crisis of some form, could be a governmental power crisis, but this is danger territory, and we're all in it. So it actually, the entire world has made a huge collective bet on how the future is going to turn out. Now, how come we all made that sort of a bet? I submit to you it's because we all have the same money system, and that actually the tail is wagging the dog in this case. We didn't choose this on purpose. What happened was we have a money system that's requiring it, so we do it. Now, I can simplify the economy to just two words. The way I look at our economy, it's something in its current incarnation that must grow. And by must, I mean in order to be happy, in order for it to behave in the ways that we want it to behave. So it's got to grow. And I want to look at that growth a little bit because it's the type of growth that's really important. And I want to just unpack and look at this thing around exponential growth quickly. So exponential growth, you know, classically you might think of it as a hockey stick chart. We're graphing an amount of something over time usually. It could be, hopefully it's your bank account, but maybe it could be could be number of McDonald's outlets, or it might, in this case, be population. So we're looking here at world population. Green is history. This little red part, if you can see it, is UN projection for the next 40 years. This is over several thousands of years. And of course, you know, I could actually, this looks kind of desperate, right? That huge hockey stick like that, but look how many years I had to graph it over. So one thing you can do with exponential charts, though, is you can fiddle with them in the sense that if I change that left axis, I can make this look more or less terrifying. So if I change that to trillions, this flattens out. It doesn't look like anything. It looks like a flat line going across. If I change this to 1 billion, this curve slides back, and it looks like we should have had a big, you know, fright maybe 80, 90 years ago. So this is kind of a trick, unless you have some sense that you can fix that left axis, meaning I can't put trillions or even 1 billion there, because I have some sense of the total amount of this particular graph right here. So in this case, world ecologists say, yeah, we think we might be able to fit somewhere between 9 and 12 billion people on the planet, looking at, you know, arable land, water, soil, all kinds of things like that. But that there is a fixed limit. So it means then that whether you're here on the chart, here or here, now has important relevance, and it's not a math artifact. It's actually very important to know where you are on this chart. But of course, we need to know where we are on a lot of charts. So here's a graph of oil production, which means consumption, because we pull it out and burn it very rapidly. And we're looking at it over time, and this becomes important because lots of groups have said, we think we know where the upper bound is on this. And whether it's 20 years from now or it was 3 years from ago, like some think, we still know it's pretty close. We can get that pretty close fixed. And this is critical because oil is the most important substance we've got for economic progression and growth. It's how we move everything around in our economy. There was an industry task force on peak oil and energy security in the UK. Consortium of five companies analyzed this brilliant stuff. They came out with their second report on February 10th. And they think that we're going to be hitting this hard upper limit, maybe 2011 to 2013. God, that's like tomorrow. That is so close. So knowing where we are on this chart is also critically important. I would submit to you that we can fix that boundary, and we've turned the corner. We're not on the flat part. We're on the steep part of this curve. And we can actually look at a variety of places everywhere. I mentioned, you know, we're surrounded by what appear to be exponentially increasing charts and all over the place, and we can find them across all these things and many more besides. Because we're surrounded by things that are growing non-linearly, but rather growing in this sort of geometric fashion, we've got to understand it. And we have to, because it's really hard as a human to figure this stuff out, because we think linearly. And the example I like to use is if I said, gave you two heavy magnets and said, you have to have them come together at a perfectly even rate until they touch, you won't be able to do it. You'll go like this, right? It's very hard to do because we think linearly. So this is not an intuitive way to think, but we're surrounded by it, so we should give it a shot. Now, compounding, in order to understand this a little better, I want to see if I can bring this chart alive, and we're going to use this example. I got a magic eyedropper, and I'm going to put a drop of water in your hand, and what's magic about this drop of water is it's going to double every minute. So I put a drop in your hand, and after 1 minute, you have two drops, and after 2 minutes, you have four drops, and after 6 minutes, you can fill a thimble. So if you got a sense of that growth, now we're going to Wembley Stadium, my world, so it's watertight, and I've handcuffed you to the highest row of bleacher seats. So you're up there, and my question to you is, if we go there tomorrow, 12 o'clock, you're handcuffed, and I go down the pitch, and I put a drop of water on there, and it starts to double, how long do you have to escape from your handcuffs? So those of you who've seen this before, you can. But for people who haven't, just a guess.
4 days, 20 minutes.
20 minutes, four days?
Yeah.
An hour? Excellent guesses. This is all good. You have until 12:50 to escape. Now, if I've completely messed this up and I've misestimated the size of Wembley by 100%, you can add a minute to that. That makes you feel better. The more important question, though, is this one. At what time is this part still 97% empty space? And how many of you realize the seriousness of your predicament?
12:48.
Perfect guesses in the back. 12:45, it's still 97% empty space. 45 minutes, nothing much seems to be happening. 5 more minutes, it's all done. All of human history to 1960 to put 3 billion people on the surface of the planet, 40 years for the next 3 billion. this concept is really important to get embedded because we don't live in a linear world. We live in a world that's very much not linear. And here's the most important nonlinear piece of them all is our oil consumption. And I will note that we had an oil shock in the early 1970s. My president at the time, Jimmy Carter, came out, put on his cardigan, said, "World, we have a problem." He spoke very eloquently about it. I put his speech up on my website because it's actually, it's crisp, focused, and exactly what you would say today. Knowing what we know today, he was just dead on the whole thing. And we waited, we got Reagan in, and then we spent 30 years building SUVs, and we had mourning in America, so we ignored it. And then we had oil shock two. This was a different beastie. This one was $147 a barrel oil in July of 2008. This was a different one because this one had, yes, it had some financial bubble speculative components on it, but it had something else we've never seen in the data series. At the peak, by July, out of the six quarters of production that we look at, in five of those, supply had been exceeded by demand. Under the most powerful market mechanism known, it would have enforced companies, countries, getting their oil out of the ground as fast as they could. The market was giving the most blazing signal it could, and we couldn't produce as much as we wanted. That, to me, is the most compelling evidence that we're very close to peak oil out of anything that's out there right now, because a lot of the other data is murky. Market data, I trust a lot in that respect. So the mistake here would be to think because we had 30 years, we've got another 30 years between this oil shock 2 and oil shock 3. We do not, because we're not on the same part of the curve, because we know where the top of this is, reasonably speaking. So it means that if we linearly extrapolate between these two, we might be making an enormous set of policy mistakes in terms of the sense of urgency and the types of solutions that we would bring to the story. So yeah, we're surrounded by these exponential charts, but I want you to take away from this one notion of speeding up, that the time is not linear in this function, that we are living in a world where, because of that speeding up function, I would submit that our opportunities are going to find ourselves, we're going to find those opportunities to be limiting and getting smaller as we go through this story. And it means to me that it's important to recognize then whether we're facing a problem which has a solution or a predicament which only has outcomes, if I can define the terms that way. These gentlemen have a problem. Any rock climbers out there, I apologize, this is a very stupid picture. But this can be solved in a number of ways. We can lower ropes, maybe they could climb down, we could put big mattresses down there, but there are ways that this could be solved with solutions so that both climbers find themselves in the same position physically that they started in. This gentleman has a predicament. He's gonna get wet. No matter how hard he pinwheels his arms, he's not going back up there. And the options now, the outcomes that he wants to manage are, is he going to land on his feet or is he going to belly flop? Knowing the difference between whether you're facing a problem or predicament is just absolutely critical in terms of the types of solutions that you're willing to entertain and the courses of actions you take. So I want to talk about energy because this is where the predicament sort of emerges for me. This is United States oil production. We have a lot of history. We've got great data, just reams of data. It's kind of maybe hard to read, but this is millions of barrels, stretching up to 10 million here in the middle years, starting in 1930, coming through to present. And we'll note that we had a peak of production in the United States in 1970. This is a fact. This little bump, if you can see it right here, is Prudhoe Bay, the largest oil find ever discovered in my country. And all it did was sort of get us a little plateau below the peak. We are now producing less than half of what we produced at our peak production. And of course, we make up the difference between what we produce and what we burn with imports. This wedge has been growing at an ever faster pace because this is falling and this is rising. So that's our predicament. We have to import oil in order for my society to function. But this story can be told all across the OECD. In the UK, a very important thing happened recently, which is that in 2005, the UK became a net energy importer again. Was an energy importer in the red for a long period. The North Sea fields came along. They peaked in 1998. They are down 47% since that moment in time. And you've since crossed over into being a net energy importer. The difference between being an energy exporter and importer is night and day. It's all the difference in the world. This is the most shocking chart to me. It came out in 2008, and it really changed my course of how I think about things and what I did in my own life. This had enormous impacts. The International Energy Agency puts out a World Energy Outlook every year, typically in fall, comes out in October usually, sometimes November. Up to 2007, they had produced this same chart, which asks how much have we produced, so you get these nice wiggly lines, which are all measurements, and then they extrapolate and say, where's it going? In 2007, in 2030, they said we were going to go to 130 million barrels a day of worldwide production, and they did that because they extrapolated from how much did we want to have. So they just took the economy, multiplied it by some nice round, you know, 3% figure, and then looked at 2030 and said, therefore, we have to have this much oil. They'd always made the assumption, because they had economists running this, they made the assumption that supply would follow demand. Right? Here's an old joke. If you put three economists in a basement, they won't worry about getting hungry, because they know their grumbling bellies will make sandwiches appear. Not to pick on any economists. I just like that joke. Sorry. So this year, though, in 2008, they did something spectacular. They took actual data production figures, and they made this huge database of actual fields that produced, looked at the decline rates of each, added new projects in, summed at the bottom, and went, whoops, two things. This only goes to 105 now. They shaved an enormous quantity of oil off. And most importantly, this is sort of marking where we roughly are. They noted that this stuff, the blue on the bottom, is crude oil from currently producing fields. They said, we're past peak on that. Not by a little bit, but by 2 years when they put this out. Now 3 years. A euphemism for oil from currently producing fields is cheap. It's easy. It's high net energy oil. It's the good stuff. This red stuff here, which we're counting on a lot, is from fields yet to be found. So we have our fingers crossed on that. And then we have all these non-conventional stuff in here. Non-conventional is a euphemism for expensive, low net energy. The difference between a pipe in the ground that spews oil out and going out and digging this tarry stuff out of sand in a bulldozer is night and day. So we see three things in this. Lowered, we're past peak on the cheap stuff, and we're going to be counting more and more on this non-conventional oil, as they call it. And the industry task force I just told you about on February 10th, they said, well, we've analyzed all the same sort of data sets, and they have their own. They came up with an upper estimate of maybe 95 million barrels a day. So we're somewhere between 105 and 95. Let's call it 100 million barrels a day. It's kind of what we think the upper limit is going to be. So this is an issue of quantity. 100 million barrels. Okay, that's not as much as we hoped for. We're not going to have the same kind of economic growth predicated on this flow of high quantities of oil flowing through it. So quantity is an issue, but there's another issue which is almost always left out of the story. It's just as important. And it's about this story right here. Forget about the money it costs to get energy. Forget about that. Ask the question, how much energy do we get back based on the amount of energy we had to put in? So if we have to use one barrel of oil to find one barrel of oil, there's no point in doing that unless we want to stay busy. What we care about, all the way on this end, what we're looking at is if we found 50 barrels after investing one barrel, we have a 98% return, if you will. So at a 50-to-1 return, we have all this green stuff under here, and the red part is what we're investing to get this amount of green. This green stuff we care about is that's what we run our world on. That's how we have a complicated society. This is how we support complexity in our world, in our daily lives, in the economy, in everything. It's the green stuff. So you notice this is also not a linear graph. It's something we need to understand because it kind of trucks along and then whoop, falls off right around 10-to-1. And it crosses at 1-to-1, where, of course, there's no benefit to doing this anymore. In 1930, the world was discovering oil that had 100-to-1 returns at minimum. It might have been higher, but that's our best guess at this point in time. And by the 1970s, we were getting returns at 25-to-1. You know what? Still a whole lot of green under that. It's barely perceptible in terms of the returns that we're getting that we can grow our economies on. By the 1990s, we think we were somewhere in the range of 18-to-1 to 10-to-1, but still, fundamentally, a lot of green there. Recently, you might have heard about there's some finds that have come up. They splash them all across the fronts of newspapers. One was in the Gulf of Mexico. It's 35,000 feet down. 35,000 feet. So go to the top of Everest, install a drilling rig, drill to the bottom, keep going. It's a long way. It's an incredibly long way. We think that find might be turning in something closer to 3-to-1 by the time all is said and done. It's an immensely complicated project to prosecute. It goes without saying you need an immensely complicated society to support a drilling rig and the technology at that magnitude. And what that means is if that's what we're left with, if we're prosecuting stuff at 3-to-1, that's the world we live in now. A whole lot of green has just disappeared from our picture. In my country, we're pursuing corn-based ethanol, which has returns of 1 to 1.5 or 2 to 1, which means that if we've said that's how we're going to live our world as on a policy basis in my country, it means we're going to try and cram our economy into this little green wedge slice down here. It just doesn't make sense from an energy standpoint. So energy return on energy invested is an incredibly important concept because it's the green stuff that gives us everything that we care about. And so it means then that quality is an issue. I'm going to call this the quality of the energy that we're getting out. It's high quality and low quality. Tar sand, low quality. Shale oil, even lower quality. The amount of net energy we can get out of that stuff is miserably small, and it's not the same. So when you hear things like, there are three Saudi Arabias locked under the American West, you need to think about this quality issue, because on a net energy basis, there isn't even a fraction of a Saudi Arabia locked under the American West. There might be no Saudi Arabias locked under there, because it might be that we can't get that stuff out with any energy return at all. We don't know yet. All right, so now we can say, all right, we got this economy that must grow, and we're now connecting it to an energy system. We're saying, oops, we have some serious adult-sized questions as to whether it can grow, and maybe it can't. And once peak oil gets underway, the idea is that it's going to decline in somewhere in the vicinity of 3 to 5% per year if we're lucky, 7 to 8% per year if we're not lucky. So Mexico's oil production is plunging at this point in time in the high teens. So they have a very difficult situation. Saudi Arabia's oil is going to decline at a much slower rate. It's just due to the geology of the different situations. So I invite you to remember this piece, though, the quality and the quantity both. And now I'm just going to very quickly detour into the environment. I'm going to tell the same story, but it's around resources. And I want to tell it around this resource. You see that thing those guys are sitting on? Can you see that? That was a copper nugget. When we first started exploiting resources in my country for the Industrial Revolution, this is the quality of the resources that we were finding. I mean, there's a stream bed there, and it's got a copper nugget in it the size of, you know, a table. Of course, we used those first. That's good stuff. And then we found the smaller nuggets, you know, and that's good. And then we moved on to the ore grades. The highest ones is a 10% ore grade. It's beautiful stuff. 10% meaning you take 10 pounds of this ore, you squish it up, and you get 1 pound of copper out. So that's a very high-grade ore. Now my country is prosecuting things that look like this. This is our largest mine. It's the Bingham Canyon mine in Utah. This used to be a mountain. Took the whole thing down. It's been one of the most prolific mines. But the copper ore that we're chasing down here at the bottom is 0.2%. That means we're taking out 500 pounds of ore to get that 1 pound of copper. Where we had 10 pounds, now we're taking 500. So I don't think about the environmental impacts or the dollar cost. Put on your energy hat and think about how much energy it takes to haul 500 pounds of rock up this big spiraling thing in order to crush it to get your 1 pound of copper out. What we find when we look across this more generally is that, yes, we found the big stuff first, and then we went to the smaller nuggets, and then we went to the higher grade ores, and then we go to the lower grade ores. And we'll come up with a generalized theoretical resource extraction profile that looks a little bit like this. You get more and more stuff out, and it's generally cheaper and cheaper to a point, and then it becomes more and more expensive as you get less and less out. Most importantly, the energy cost, as you go across this curve, is not linear. It goes like this, because we went from pure copper to 10% ore grades to 2.2% ore grades. Most uranium finds right now are in the vicinity of 0.1 to 0.01%. So imagine how much material has to be removed in order to get it at that stuff. And of course, the cost will sort of follow along with that as well, but they're really just a reflection of the energy costs at the end of the day. So now I say, well, okay, we have this thing that must grow, and we've connected it to this thing that can't grow, and we have some serious concerns about key mineral resources that we care deeply about as the products that we flow into our economy. Around from the environment, if you will. And that there's a lot of these that are depleting at rates that are not linear, and it's staggering how fast they're depleting. It's gotten interesting enough out in that space that there is one large, beautiful copper deposit left in the world that we know about. It's in a valley in Afghanistan. Can't get to it. It's very difficult to get there right now. And China bought it for $1 billion more than anybody else even thought about bidding. Because it's one of the last places we can look at and find ourselves back up on this part of the curve. I invite you to remember quantity and quality. It's actually a story that fits on both of the energy and environment stories. So is this a problem or is this a predicament? I mean, where are we in this story? Is this something that we're going to fix by tweaking a few policies, or is this going to require us to fundamentally re-examine the basis of our economy? Because you know what? There are economic models and systems that do not require exponential growth. That's possible. But the one we have does. And so I've outlined a couple of ways we could look at that, putting our energy and our resources hats on to say, yeah, we might be getting somewhere. Now, at this point, usually there's somebody in the audience thinking, oh, the Malthusian argument. He was proved wrong 200 years ago. To that, I reply that I think we have access to better information today than they did in the 1700s when Malthus developed his arguments, which were fundamentally right, but maybe way ahead of his time. And you know, remember, he was alive at the time when wood was the dominant form of energy. Coal hadn't even really come into large-scale play at that point in time. So we went from wood to coal. We went from coal to oil. And I will change my view as to whether we're facing a problem or predicament if and only if somebody can answer we go from oil to what? There's a question mark there. And I don't see anything there that we know about at this stage, and I would submit to you that we have access to incredibly good information about what kind of energy sources truly exist on this planet. So there's that formula. We have these, you know, the three E's, which are the environment, energy, and the economy. I think we have to look at all three at once, hold them in their totality, thinking about how they interact with each other, because a solution tried to apply to any one of them is going to ripple across to the other ones. It's like squeezing a balloon, and both ends pop out. I think we have to look at the whole piece. Quantity and quality, and it's particularly that quality story. That one does not get enough airtime. We don't understand it really very well at this point. There's a lot more we could be doing there in terms of deepening our understanding of that. And it all adds up, I think, to a predicament, which really is a fancy way of saying I think we need to really seriously consider non-status quo solutions at this point, at least as part of our set of things that we're considering. The question comes to, you know, what do we do about that? How are we doing on time?
Fine.
Great. I think that what we really need to consider is that we're at a moment where I say, you know, we're going to be at this sharp corner of the road. I think what this means to me is that we're changing paradigms. The old paradigm, quite simply, I think we could count on having more energy each year. And this has been true not for just a little while. This has actually been true for as long as humans have been alive in terms of our overall societal structure. What if the new paradigm means that we have slightly less energy each year? That's an enormous shift. It means we're going to have to change so much in how we think, how we approach problems and predicaments, and how we think about things. This is actually a fairly phenomenal switch that's going to require a culture change as much as it requires intellectual knowledge and political paradigm changes. Where we had more resources each year, it's pretty much clear to me that once we go past peak oil, we are not going to be digging those holes that I showed you that look like Bingham Canyon mine. We will then be triaging and using our energy for more important things. I submit to you, a giant hole in the earth is not as important as growing food. So it turns out that more resources each year under the old paradigm, if peak oil, when peak oil comes, it's going to translate into fewer resources, which means that reduce, reuse, recycle is not a set of green slogans anymore. It's an actual new economic imperative that we have to now manage, because we're not going to be just taking as much as we want. We're going to have to be much more clever about how we use what we already have. Where each year we had reliable economic growth, I think that in this world, if we have slightly less energy each year, we're going to have to get used to this, which is pretty reliable economic shrinkage every year. It's a completely different paradigm. How we manage under this world versus this world is utterly different. And I'm not here to say that it's going to be utterly bad. It's just going to require us to think about it in different ways, because this is just a different way. And I know that we can come up with models that will allow us to operate within this world just fine. But operating the old way under this new paradigm, I think, is going to be a recipe for a lot of disappointment, maybe worse, because this old model really doesn't fit into this new sort of a view. So again, non-status quo solutions, really outside of the box. So what does that really mean? The first thing is, I think we have to get our story right. So we had a story running until 2005 that said, houses always go up in price. It was a very good story. A lot of people bought into it. And we made a lot of bad decisions on the basis of that. And there's a lot of economic pain that we're going to be living with for a long time, because it turned out the story was wrong. And the interesting thing is that we've proven this story to be wrong several times. Houses went down in price during the Great Depression. They've gone down in price at other periods. But somehow we convinced ourselves that this time was different and that houses do not go down in price. And they do. So we need to get that story right. So here I'm talking about what are some other stories that we might have in operation today that could be wrong? Well, one of them, I think, is that, you know, we need to have economic growth every year. We tell ourselves that story, but in truth, we don't actually need it. It turns out our money system needs it. So understanding that story is going to be vitally important in order to come up with what I would call actual responses. At this stage, in what I've been doing in my work, I no longer care about where people fall on this spectrum. I don't care what you put across the spectrum. You could put old, young there, east, west, this religion or that religion, old, young. I don't care about that anymore because I believe this story is urgent enough that what really matters now is whether or not we're making the right choices or whether we're making the wrong choices. And I truly believe that our choices today are going to be magnified manyfold, both the good ones and the bad ones, because of where we are in the story. In times past, I think we made a huge mistake. We made a bad choice or a wrong choice. Bad's a judgment word. Let me use wrong. I made this wrong choice, right, in 1970s when we turned away from the original oil shock and said, we're not going to look at that. I think we're going to look back on that and say, that was a really bad decision. We actually should have paid attention on that first shot across the bow. That was a very good time. But if we turn away from that story again and say our most important, pressing, imperative thing that we have to do is get the world economy growing again as rapidly as possible, I think we're going to discover is a wrong choice. But this time, it's going to be worse because we do not have the luxury of 30 more years of energy growth to cover up that mistake on this pass through. The work, as I see it, first and foremost, is to raise awareness around this issue, to start telling the comprehensive story, because politicians aren't going to be able to do anything in terms of really making non-status quo decisions without some sort of political cover. And this awareness, you know, I found that having this awareness early enough in my life made an enormous difference in terms of my own personal well-being. And I see that certain communities have made that same judgment, and they're interested in raising awareness so that they can get out in front of this story for themselves and help mitigate some of the things that are coming. But this should also be at the national level. So awareness is the first part, but simple awareness isn't good enough. You got to go deeper than that. And this is where work of organizations like this one come into play. There's so much to be done that it has to be done to deepen our understanding. So if I'm aware that I have, you know, my engine lights come on, I'm aware I have engine problems. If I pull over and I have no understanding of how my engine works, and I start, you know, applying solutions myself on the side of the road to my engine, I'm probably going to make it worse. I submit that we have to have awareness, we've got to broaden it and deepen it, and we've got to take it down after that point into solutions. So that's the work, and I see myself largely existing here. You know, this is the work that I do for the most part, but I'm working very hard to try and figure out how to support all the rest of this stream as well. We need a vision. You know, in World War II, people were asked to recycle rubber and tin and buy war bonds, and they did it. And they did it because we had a compelling vision of something that we wanted to do. At the time, it wasn't called sacrifice. It wasn't painted in any terms like that. People said, there's something very important we have to do, and we did it. And we did it willingly. In the absence of a national narrative that makes sense, people are figuring out these visions on their own. There are communities all over the place. This is my primary work. I mostly go and I talk to people at the municipal level, groups, organizations that have said, the story I'm being told in my newspaper at the national level doesn't make sense, so they've started to do this for themselves and figure out where they want to head. But I would submit that we really desperately need a national narrative that makes sense, that jives with the reality of the story. If I could wave a magic policy wand, a huge body of work would be this. We need a national or an international or a UN or a something, extremely well-funded commission that can study energy return on energy invested. Because we have no idea what it is. We actually don't know what the energy return on energy invested is for almost anything that we do. And I would submit that what we could do is we can actually just add up for all the things we could do, the energy return on energy invested, forget politically if it's something we want to do, or economically if it makes sense at the time. Just get a list and sort it top to bottom, and it would tell us, we'd be able to answer questions like today, should we insulate existing structures or should we build a new CAS pipeline? I don't know. What's going to be the energy return on this to our society? How does that improve the energy flows in society? We don't know. And it's complicated because if we just wanted to even answer, well, how much energy is it going to take to insulate a house? Well, you got to make the insulation, but where did that come from? So we chase that out, and you know, where do we put the boundary on the energy flows to create the insulation? Then there's the workers who have to install it. They had to drive on some roads in cars, and where did their food come from? So it's really, you know, it becomes immensely complicated very rapidly to answer the question, how much energy did it take to do this versus do this? And then what's the return on that? Because you have to answer that question too. So it's not simple work. It's not trivial. And where you draw the boundary on that is you know, every inch you move that boundary out, the complexity just multiplies enormously. So this actually is going to require not just a few people sort of poking around in a couple of research universities. I think this is going to take an incredible concerted effort because it's everything. How would we answer this question? Should we build a new rail line, or should we encourage smaller vehicles? Ooh, you know, now we have to start answering policy impacts of policy and stuff. This is tricky, right? Or perhaps you want to answer this one. Should we do fission, more fission, nuclear fission, or should we do wind power? We actually don't know the answers to these from an energy standpoint. We can tell you politically what's possible. We can tell you economically what it looks like. But we don't know the actual energy question. So think about this. Like, even if we said, this is going to be immensely difficult to answer because, say how gas is subsidized across the world. $9 a gallon in the Netherlands, 17 cents a gallon in Venezuela. In my own country, gas allegedly costs $2.80, $3 a gallon, somewhere in that zone. But that's because we hide the military costs of securing that in a different budget portion. But if we layer that back on, according to the Cato Institute, the true cost of gasoline in my country is around $8 a gallon. So in terms of the economics, you know, it doesn't make sense to do this because gas only costs that, doesn't answer the question as crisply. It's just answering the question, tell me how much energy we use, watts, ergs, joules, I don't care how you measure it, and what are we getting back? And I think things will come into much different focus, and I would submit to you that making decisions based on EROI will give you good economic returns, because it turns out it's more efficient, and it's a more effective way to look at the problem, and it would actually, I think, clarify the situation. Thank you. I think that's where I wanted to stop there, so I will. And
that's fantastic. Thank you very much. Okay, what I suggest now is we take some questions. We will have a break for coffee in about half an hour. When we come back for coffee, I'm going to ask everyone to introduce themselves and say who they are, where they're from, and why they're here today. But I think we ought to start with some questions because I think people may be burning to actually ask some questions. So, yes, Paul.
Do you think there will ever be the leadership and political will to do the kinds of things that you're suggesting need to be done without some catastrophe, which of course the Second World War was?
So it depends where when we say will there and where. I think democratic countries are going to usually do what they usually do, which is wait for the catastrophe or some harder signal before they get busy. And the good news is they respond relatively well to crises. The problem in this story is that I think this next crisis is going to be very structurally different from past ones, and that we'll be very disappointed in having waited until the crisis was upon us before we started reacting. I can name a country that, in my judgment, already is responding to this story well in advance of it and has been for a number of years, and that's China. For at least 7 years now, they've been on a very quiet but active campaign in mercantilist policy of going out and securing resources. Arable land in Africa and Madagascar. They've been buying oil from Venezuela. They bought that copper mine, not yet, but the copper valley in Afghanistan. They've been buying trees, rocks, minerals from Canada. All over the world, they've been pursuing a story that fits perfectly into this framework. Now, whether this is an accident and they've just been out buying commodities because that's what they like to do, you know, that's a possibility, but I don't think so. I think they've got leadership in place that already sees where this stuff is going. China is now the world leader in alternative technologies. That wasn't an accident. They had a very concerted push in their country to develop the technologies in order to be a leader in alternative and renewable technologies for energy. All of this looks like a concerted plan that worries me because it looks like they're 100 yards down the track and my country hasn't even figured out that there's a race on yet. Right? Just based on what I see. Right? It's possible we have plans and people are aware of it and all of this, but in terms of what I can detectably measure and see, I don't see that my country or, in fact, much of the West has really gotten in front of this game in terms of resources. So, what do I think the most likely outcome is? I truly believe that in order for our leaders to lead in this case, they're going to need some political cover, which means we out here on the outside have to give them the territory to be bold. In my country, I can't think of a single example where the status quo, which is what we're talking about here, is a fundamental change to the status quo of thinking, maybe even power structures a little bit. I can't think of anything like that that started in Washington, D.C. and then spread out. They were all brought kicking and screaming inwards. environmental movement, labor rights, women's rights, civil rights. Could go down a long list. They all started with movements of concerned people who then raised the attention and brought it inward. So I still think that's probably the model that has the most chance of success. The question in my mind is whether that can happen fast enough to match the scale, the pace of this story.
Thank you.
If we were all doing the Chinese rate of running, if we were all equal in this 100-yard race, we would simply be moving faster and faster towards that critical predicament point in terms of resources that
right.
we're talking about. It doesn't seem to me that that's an answer in any fashion or form. That just shortens the time curve within which much more fundamental change needs to take place.
Exactly, but that's if we're going to stand over here on the side of the old paradigm and say, because we want to pursue this, we're just going to go out and secure all the resources we can so we continue to do
that's
this.
Exactly what China is doing, isn't it?
They are, but I'm wondering if they don't have a transition story built in their mind which says, quick, go out and get all this stuff and bring it in. So here's a piece of evidence that really confused me at the time, but I think it makes sense now. I was watching the price of copper, because Dr. Copper is an awesome market predictor, right? Dr. Copper is what it's called to traders. Dr. Copper kept going up during the whole crisis, and it was because somebody was buying it. And it turned out that China, in 2009, bought twice as much copper as it had any year prior. They had no need for it, because their exports were plunging. They're just piling it up and warehousing it. And so maybe they're looking ahead and saying there's better economic days right around the corner, we plan to export it. But it looks a little bit like stockpiling. So I dig into that and I find that they bought things that don't rust, that store easily, they've been buying more than they need on a pretty aggressive basis. So there is a story there. You're absolutely right. If we all did that, the story would be over much faster. But if we can shift to the new paradigm and say, yes, we need these resources, but even more importantly, we have to conserve what we've got. We have to very aggressively begin a program of changing how we flow resources through our economy, and we've got to start wrestling with that story. We should probably be doing both at the same time, figuring out what our sources are, adding them up, sort of dividing by how much we think we need, and pursuing a very aggressive policy of change around how we utilize those resources. Because a lot of stuff still goes to the dump. I mean, very expensive, important resources. We are still in the process of taking highly concentrated mineral bodies and dispersing them, which is, you know, that's an entropy act. And we need to stop the entropy in the story very rapidly.
Absolutely. Then Greg at the back, and then. Can you say who you are, by the way, please?
My name's Dan Sturgill. A couple of years ago, I did your crash course, and I remember when I did it, you said the next 20 years will be completely unlike the last 20 years. And that made me frightened and shocked. But it's happening. I mean, I see it happening. The sovereign debt default. You know, and they're talking not just about Greece, but they're talking about many, many countries. And I can see fiat currencies that are going to crash and all over the world. It's the debt bubbles burst all over the world. It's some people call it like a slow train wreck. So isn't that going to change our lifestyles completely and deal in some way with the energy problem, the environmental problem?
It will. So if we could just remove two of the E's, we're only talking about the economy. I can paint a story there which has enough risks on it that we, as prudent individuals, investors, we should say, whoa, what's going on here? And that is the debt story. So the debt, you know, the thing is that debt, if we just built our economy in a spreadsheet and said, how does it work? How does money come in? How does money go away again? Because when you pay off the debt, money's created and destroyed in the act of lending. Well, the principal is created and destroyed. The interest stays there constantly. And that interest defines the rate of growth of the system. So we can just build that in a spreadsheet and discover that it goes whoop at some point, right? And more interestingly, you can discover that if you put enough columns on this thing, that eventually one person ends up with all the wealth in the world. It's just kind of how the system theoretically operates. In the real world, we discover there's some wealth redistribution and stuff that happens, but really it's actually been behaving startlingly close to what you would theoretically predict. The accumulation of wealth in the last 20 years has been absolutely phenomenal. In the last 10 years, it's picked up pace. It's gotten even more rapid recently. And so we can look at that and go, wow, what's going on here? But it's really just how the system is designed and constructed. But all debt systems happen to have a point beyond which they no longer operate. And just economically, you can mathematically say there's a point at which they actually crash themselves. And this isn't actually a new concept. So in the Bible, they talk about a jubilee, which is what was enforced in a period of 7-7, so after 49 years, they had debt-based money systems, but they understood how they operated. So what Jubilee was, in the year 49, all debts outstanding would be canceled and wiped out, and they would become worthless, and people would start over again, because the system became untenable after 7-7s. So since everybody knew that was the system, what they would do is, starting in about year 40, they would start not loaning money. So it had a way of sort of automatically, you know, titrating itself back down to zero anyway. But it was well known there, and it's also described in the Torah, it's also in the Quran. I mean, this is a very well understood process, that when you have a compound-based money system, it has a terminal point at some point. So the question is, how do you manage that? Just economically, I have concerns that it looks like most governments have decided that they're going to take the route of printing money as the means to get out of that fix, because it provides the easiest, simplest, least path of resistance. The other alternative is austerity, right? You know, so that's where you vastly cut payments and you vastly raise taxes, and it's very deeply unpopular. And there are not any historical examples where that's been willingly undertaken by a sovereign nation. So the point you raise is that just on the economic front alone, there's enough to be concerned about that we might be heading towards a debt train wreck, if you will, sovereign defaults. But now we put these other two E's in here, and we've got it really adds a lot of a new flavoring to that particular story, right? And so I think that all of us should seriously consider what the implications of that are. At this point, I think there's at least a 25% chance of a major currency crisis existing somewhere in the US, the UK, or the EU within the next 5 years. If you told me I had a 25% chance of my house burning down in the next 5 years, I wouldn't live in it, but I'd certainly take out a lot of insurance on it, right? And there's things we can do that are the equivalent of getting out of the house and taking insurance out in order to protect ourselves. So that is something that I also very strongly advocate and counsel we should do, because the risks are so high.
Exactly, yes. Greg?
Hi, Chris. Greg Fisher. I have a million things I could mention and talk about and ask about, but I'll just identify one for now. The economic model that you demonstrated was based on Musk growth. I completely accept that, but how much was that? I got the sense that you were basically modeling America, okay, and friends, or the Washington model countries, including the UK, because China's got a very different sort of mercantilist model, and I wonder the extent to which sort of money-based Musgrove economy is a result of Western institutions which have essentially had to pump prime their economies in compensation to the Chinese and friends running mercantilist models. Do you see where I'm going?
Yeah, I do, but China actually has the same money system we do. There's a condition of the IMF that if you're going to be able to submit letters of credit, which are what are required in order to ship between two countries, your banking system has to operate in a certain way. So the IMF has set certain conditions out to say, if you want to play at all in the international game and have ships and money go across oceans, you have to structure yourselves like this. So they're all still fundamentally, we're operating with the same money systems. Now within that, there are obviously very different ways that politically that can organize, and I think China has a different political organization.
But if I suspect if you look at China,